Well, this is the last in our series, Be the Man. And I wonder, Emma, if I could trouble you to give out these slips, one each around on this side. Stephen, if you could do this side, please. This will come in handy in a moment. And we've been looking through this series on what it means to be a bloke, in a Christian bloke, in our 21st century Western contemporary culture. Messages applicable to women too, but we really wanted the blokes to sit up and take notice and have a think about that. And on one level, it's about how you as blokes channel your testosterone. Because, of course, a worldly message would be that if someone bashes you as a bloke, then you bash them back, would be a typical message. But Paul here, as he writes to the Christians in Rome, gives a radically different message to that and suggests a different alternative way. And what he calls for is for the Christians to be like Jesus and do what Jesus did, which I'm going to coin a phrase here, is active non-violence opposition. Active non-violent opposition. Now, a key word in there, as well as the non-violence part, is active. This does mean making a stand, as I talked about a few weeks ago. It doesn't mean just letting people walk all over you, but making a stand, being active, coming against that, but with a non-violence, different approach. Now, we're going to read this passage in a special way. The Bible is full of these structures, and those of you who were here, if you can think back, it was Christmas Eve, the Sunday before Christmas Day, last Christmas. We looked at a passage, and we saw it had a special structure where you could start, rather than reading it linearly in a sort of Greek Western way from beginning to end, you could start at the beginning, work into the center, and then work back out. And you found that as you worked back out, it complemented and paired with the verses that you worked in. Now, who was here Christmas Eve? Who can remember what that is called? Speak it out louder. Yes, a chiasm is a chiastic structure. That's very good. That's the technical word. There's an easier word for it. Can anyone remember that? It's called a ring structure. A chiastic structure is a ring structure because the outer verses or the outer concepts doesn't necessarily fall in verse boundaries, but the outer concepts forms an outer ring. And then you go one level in, and the next concept, beginning and towards the end, forms the next ring. And then you go another level in and you get another ring. And eventually you get to the center, the heart of a passage. And then work your way back out. A ring structure. That's why I've given you these slips with all its color coding and lines and things to help you, an indentation, to help you see that structure. So verse 14 pairs with verse 21 and says, bless and do not persecute. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. See how those concepts go together in verse 14 and 21. Bless and don't persecute. Don't be overcome by evil. Overcome evil with good. Interestingly, the Greek word for overcome can also be translated conquer. Do not be conquered by evil, but instead you conquer evil with goods by being a people of blessing, people who will bless rather than persecute. Now that means to live strangely, to live radically different to what the rest of the world would normally do. The world cannot get this because it is so odd. But remember, it was earlier in this year, we were doing a series on community and what does it mean to be Christian community. And one of the things we said is that it means that we are strange. Remember the phrase, Christians are peculiar. Because we live differently, we bless rather than persecute. And seek to conquer evil with good. It strikes me that persecuted Christians are places in the world where they're locked up, put in prison, or beaten up for their faith. It strikes me that you never hear of those Christians praying against their persecutors. But in all the stories that we hear through charities like Open Doors and the feedback we get, they talk of themselves praying for their persecutors, blessing rather than persecuting. Now, I've tried to do this, and it's hard work. I had an annoying colleague at work, and the way they worked and some of the things they did brushed up against my work, and to be quite honest, it was blooming annoying. And I was like, and I started thinking, can I go to the boss and get their boss to sort them out and what have you? But then I thought, no, I need to pray, and I need to pray a blessing on their life. A bit like the exercise we did with the children earlier. And so I disciplined myself in my own private personal prayer. And I prayed and I imagined blessing for them. What would be the best for them? And it was really hard because, of course, my mind had been thinking, oh, they've annoyed me. But then I thought, no, Lord, bless them. May they be the best colleague they can be. May they be best at their job. May they find blessing through their work. It's really hard, but it is a good discipline to take on, to pray blessing for those who annoy you. This is being active. Not simply passive, not simply just slurping up all the bad stuff that you can weigh, but turning it into active and praying blessing. Remember, there's that quote. I Googled it, and it's kind of hard to know exactly which century it was first said and who first said it, but it comes over now like this. For evil to triumph just needs good people to do nothing. Evil can triumph by good people simply doing nothing, which is why we have active in this phrase, active nonviolent opposition. Well, let's go the next level in verses 15 and 20. Rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn. In other words, go with people, understand their world, understand how they see things, what they are going through. Walk with them through it. Well, why would you do that? Well, quite simply, because that's what God does. That's what God does with you. God walks with you through your stuff. So be like God and walk with other people through their stuff. Rejoicing as they rejoice, mourn as they mourn. But see verse 20. If an enemy is hungry, then feed him. If they're thirsty, then give them a drink. To me, that's the same. Rejoice with those who rejoice. If your enemy is hungry, then give him something to eat. Mourn with those who mourn. If your enemy is thirsty, then give them a drink, of course. It's the same concept. But here's the rub, isn't it? In that it's one thing to go with someone who you like, who's your friend or you get on well with, but it's quite another to try and do that with someone you don't like who is an active enemy. See how challenging this passage is. This passage is saying, look, if your enemy is hungry, then feed them. Rejoice if they're rejoicing. Mourn with them if they are mourning. Don't just do it with your friends, but do it with your enemies too. Well, we heard that in one of the episodes in this series where It was Emma talking about the story with Elisha and his servant, and the attacking army had come. And a few interesting episodes. The Elisha then said to his servant, look, you can see the angel army there on our side. It's all going to be fine. The attacking army was struck blind temporarily, led to the Israelite king. And, of course, the Israelite king said to Elisha, thanks for bringing the rebel army against me into my hands as my captives, because now I can bump them off just as any king would do against their enemies. But Elisha said, no, give them a banquet, feed them, and then send them back home so that they can come and fight you another day, would be the logic. How would that work? But that's what Elisha said to do. If your enemy is hungry, then feed them. If they're rejoicing, then rejoice with them. If they're mourning, mourn with them. Well, I want to take a little side order here. You'll notice in the passage it has this business about, then you'll heap coals on their heads. That's a quote from Proverbs 25, verses 21 and 22. And you'll leave room for God's wrath, which is from Deuteronomy 32 to 35, as a kind of a poem song at the tail end of Deuteronomy that has that. What is all that about? How do we understand that? That seems to go against the grain of what we are talking about. That doesn't seem to be a grace-filled response. Well, it's like what we see in a number of the Psalms, where you'll see if you methodically read through the Psalms, a number of the Psalms will say, against my enemy, do this, and may my enemies experience this, that, and the other, and this harsh stuff. There's a technical word for all this. It's called imprecation. Imprecation. And what that means is speaking harshness against your enemy. But here's the thing. You speak harshness against your enemy, but, big but, bold letters, you leave the actual action up to God. So you speak the harshness, this is how you feel, it's a natural reaction, but you leave any action, any following through, up to God. Maybe God will find a way of grace with this person. Maybe God will decide not to punish that enemy. Maybe God will find a different way. No matter, you've spoken it out, but that's where it ends for you. You leave the rest to God's imprecation. That's what these verses are doing. Well, now we're ready to move in to the next level, which forms the center of this passage, verses 16 and 17, 18 and 19. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to split verse 16 into three mini verses, A, B and C. And you'll see that they themselves form a block in its own right in verse 16. And then you'll see that verses 17, 18 and 19 also forms a block in its own right. And the clever clever thing is that block of 16, A, B, and C balances with a block 17, 18, and 19. So verse 16A, live in harmony with one another. Well, if you're going to live in harmony with other people, there's no room for pride. You can't do harmony that well if you're beefing up yourself with pride a lot of the time. In fact, it requires you to lower yourself, to be at the same level as other people, lowering yourself. So that means that conceit is way out of the question. So live in harmony, no room for pride. That means you're going to lower yourself. No room for conceit. Verse 16, A, B, and C. Interestingly, the Greek word for conceit kind of has this sense, as far as I can tell, of self-elevation. And here's the thing, isn't it? In our Western culture, especially for blokes with their bravado, our Western culture would say that a man self-raises, a man bigs themselves up, a man puts themselves forward with all this bravado and stuff. But Jesus self-lowers. A man self-raises, but Jesus self-lowers. Jesus actively lowers himself. That's what we celebrate at Christmas, the incarnation of God. This is what's described in another letter of Paul to the Philippians, chapter 2. Paul says, look, Jesus doesn't consider equality of God something to be grasped, to raise yourself up, to grab, but no, rather he self-empties and comes down into human form. God lowers into human form in his creation. Active self-lowering. Putting yourself on the same level. Let us play that out time and time again as we witness to other people. Because when we're witnessing to other people, any sense of status, any sense of rank or station and that, all that needs to go out of the window. All of that is irrelevant. As I've said before, when I'm talking to someone at the food bank, it doesn't matter what state they're in, it doesn't matter what state I'm in, it doesn't matter that I've got a degree in theology and engineering and all that stuff, and maybe they're educated, maybe they're not, it doesn't matter. All that matters is that in that moment, while they're coming for help in the food bank and talking with me or others, all that matters is that somehow, perhaps, by them meeting with me, they might discover Jesus through my life. That's the only thing that matters. Status, state, education, rank is irrelevant at that point. Active self-lowering. Another example of this is a great set of people from the 1700s. And these people were from Europe, and they were called the Moravians. And they were a great set of people. They experienced an incredible move of the Spirit of God. The 1700s, the same time frame as the Countess of Huntingdon, by the way. The same time frame as Wesley and Whitfield. So just as the Spirit of God was moving across England with the Countess and Wesley and Whitfield, it was also, thank God, moving in Europe, especially amongst these Moravian people. And they were so moved by the Spirit of God that they felt that they wanted to witness to the black slaves who were being exported from Africa across to the plantations in the West Indies. And so they said, we will go across to the West Indies and we will witness and bring the gospel, the good news, to these slaves on the plantation. And they said, we will go to any lengths to bring them the good news. If necessary, we will sell ourselves as slaves to do that. In other words, we will become exactly like they have been forced to be, but we will do so willingly so that we might tell them the good news. Awesome set of people. And they went, they didn't have to sell themselves into slavery, but they were able to go and witness, and they saw black slaves come to Christ. Now, there were other missionaries who went. There were British missionaries from churches in England who went. But the Moravians were different. The Moravians worked alongside and mixed with the black slaves, whereas the other missionaries kept things in compartments. They had their white Western life and then the excursions into telling some slaves about the good news. And when the Moravians set up churches, they trained the new black slaves who had come to Christ to be preachers themselves so that they could explain the gospel to their friends and neighbours. The white other missionaries from England and other places did not do this. They maintained a church hierarchy that they brought with them from England. The Moravians were an incredible bunch of people. Check them out. See in verse 16, the two do nots. Do not be proud. Do not be conceited. Surrounds the centre of active lowering. So there you have, in verse 16, a mini chiasm, a mini chiastic structure in just one little verse. It forms a block of its own. But then we see in 17 to 19, do not repay evil with evil, which of course equates to verse 19, do not take revenge. That again forms a mini chiasm, a mini ring structure. And in the middle of that sandwich is verse 18, live at peace with everyone. Sandwiched there between, do not repay evil with evil, do not take revenge. Live at peace. So you see how that block balances the block of verse 16. But before we do that, another little side note. Paul is realistic and says, as far as it is possible with you, live at peace with everyone. In other words, you cannot guarantee that you will win someone over. You can't guarantee that you will do that. So Paul is saying, do your bit as far as it is possible with you. Do your stuff of living this strange, peculiar kingdom life. But at the end of the day, you can't guarantee that the enemy is going to be won over. That's between them and God. So do your bit and leave the rest up to God. Maybe you'll win them over, it'll be fantastic, but you may not. And you may have to just accept that and go on blessing. So, as I said, these 16 complements, 17 to 19. Live in harmony echoes, do not take revenge. Active lowering echoes, live at peace. Do not be conceited echoes, do not repay evil. The two mini blocks form the centre of this passage. But then see at the very heart, the epicentre of this passage, if you like, is what I've labelled verse 16c and verse 17, which are highlighted in red. Do not be conceited. Do not repay evil with evil. You could do a lot worse than go out from this message today, setting this epicenter as your kind of mode for living going forward, to not be conceited, to not repay evil for evil. You could do a lot worse than do that. See that as the heart of the passage. And so you see how reading it with this ring structure makes it a beautiful thing in just 7-8 verses. How the surrounding of blessing, not persecuting, conquering evil with good, surrounds this beating heart of not being conceited and not repaying evil with evil. But now I want to give you some examples of other people who have done this stuff. This passage is effectively the theory for active non-violent opposition. But now let's have some examples of people who have lived that out. I've already mentioned the Moravians. Now another people group beginning with M, the Mennonites. Again, from Europe, slightly earlier, a century earlier, Baptist was where helped the English Baptists form. And the main thing about Mennonites is that they are active in peacemaking. And they are completely 100% pacifist. And today they will run courses on peacemaking and conflict resolution. If you want to know how to do conflict resolution, whether you're a Christian or whether you're in a secular sphere, you go to the Mennonites. That's where you go for this stuff. The Mennonites were involved behind the scenes quietly in the peace negotiations that led up to the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland. Because that's what they do. They quietly facilitate and provide the way for making peace, the Mennonites. Well, another example, we now go back to World War II, and that wonderful film that it was, John, you took us to see at the cinema, didn't you? Hacksaw Ridge, about this American trooper, Desmond Doss, who was a pacifist, and he would not hold a gun, and yet he signed up, enlisted in the US Army to go to the front line against the Japanese. But he would not hold a gun, and even in training, where they said, right, now it's your turn to learn to fire a gun, he said, no, I'm not going to do that. That's not what I signed up for. He got himself into a lot of trouble, but eventually won his case to be a frontline combat medic without ever having held a gun. And of course, the story plays out. You watch the film, Hacksaw Ridge's incredible film, a lot of blood and gore, but incredible how God uses him to save many, many lives on that frontline battlefield. Another example, that's World War II. Let's go now to the last 15 years. A British guy, a Baptist, an ordinary Baptist church member called Norman Kember. But he's not ordinary, he's a peace activist. And he went out, I think it was 2004, 5-ish, maybe 6. He went out to Iraq in the midst of all the Iraq War II and all that stuff and post 9/11 and all that kind of stuff going on. He went out to Iraq to promote dialogue and peace. But he was taken hostage and held hostage for 4 months. And there were times when the Foreign Office said to his family, his relatives, he said, look, all contact has gone cold. As far as we know, from what we can tell, what's going on out there, he is probably now dead. But his family and friends didn't settle for that. Each time the Foreign Office told them that, they went and held a silent prayer vigil in Trafalgar Square. Each time they did that, within days, the hostage takers sent a proof of life video so that they knew he was alive. Now, the irony of Norman Kember in this hostage situation is that he was then rescued by the SAS. It's an irony that he still wrestles with to this day. Him himself as an out-and-out pacifist and a peacemaker was rescued by the SAS. You know, full kit, raid, the whole works. But get this, in that raid, not a single shot was fired. Figure it out. Let's go back from 15 years ago, back to the 60s, and one of my favourites, which of course is in America, Martin Luther King, with the race relations and his active stance to go against the hideous injustice that America had at that time. And another wonderful film which I recommend you watch. It's not so violent and gory. It's a wonderful portrayal of how mass protest, active non-violent protest, can be done in the film Selma. As he leads a protest against the oppression that black people had, which was preventing them from being able to vote. And, of course, the other things that he did. The point of firing all these people out to you is they're all examples of activists. They're all examples of people who did or do stuff. They don't just take things lying down. But they do stuff, but in an active, non-violent way. So a question for us going into the summer, our final out question of this term up on the screen there, is where is God needing you to handle people differently? Where is God needing you to take a different approach than the normal world's approach? And the challenge with that is offer peace and not revenge. Now, if someone is coming at you and is your enemy and is hurting you, that is incredibly hard. This whole passage, verses 14 to 21, you live that out. You will find it incredibly hard, gut-wrenchingly hard. It will not go well for you. It will not be a walk in the park. But that is the challenge, to put this theory in these verses into practice. Remember that we've said throughout this series, we've used from 2 Corinthians chapter 10 a background verse all the way that says, we live in a world, we do not wage war as the world does. There is a struggle going on, there is a fight, but the weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, the weapons we use have divine power to demolish strongholds. We're in a struggle. We're in a difficulty, but we fight with different weapons. The evil comes, and it comes, and it comes like waves of the sea crashing against the rocks. But the call for Christians is not to simply just let those waves come and come and crash and crash, but to live differently. Because whilst those waves will keep coming, the kingdom of God will endure, will stand, will prevail. It does that through ordinary followers of Jesus, like you and me, making our stands, not being conceited, not repaying evil with evil, actively lowering ourselves just as God has already done in Jesus, looking for harmony and not revenge, going with people, understanding their worlds, doing that even with our enemies, being a people of blessing, who will conquer evil with good. That is the call for us in the 21st century, men and women, to put this active, non-violent opposition into practice might just be the most manly thing you ever do. Let's pray. Dear Father God, help us to work out what it means to put it into practice. To let those words, those verses, form our beating heart of faith. And may we have no fear, but walk towards you and the glory that you have at the end of the day. Because your way is glorious. Amen. We're going to watch the video from the Selma film. Some of you will have seen it before. We used it at the first Imagine that we ever did, which wonderfully kind of sums up and brings into music and video form this sense of active non-violent opposition. So let's play the vid.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure.
To the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure.
Woman and child, even Jesus got his crown in front of a crowd. They march with the torch, we gon' run with it now. Never look back, we done gone hundreds of miles from dark roads, heroes to become a hero. Facing the League of Justice, his power was the people. Enemy is lethal, a king became regal. Saw the face of Jim Crow under a bald ego. The biggest weapon is to stay peaceful. We sing, our music is the cuts that we bleed through. Somewhere in the dream we had an epiphany. Now we right the wrongs in history. No one can win a war individually. It takes the wisdom of the elders and young people's energy. Welcome to the story we call victory. The coming of the Lord, my eyes have seen the glory.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours.
Heading, but the road ahead is hard but enabled by Christ. So let's stand and sing our final song.